thanks everyone for coming. Welcome to today's webinar on the Open Court Principles and the use of non-disclosure agreements or NDAs in air passenger complaints. This webinar is part of the Consumer Protection Law course here at Queen's Law. If you have any questions about the course, especially if you're a current Queen's student, please feel free to contact me after the webinar, and you can find my contact information on the Queen's Law website. For those of us joining from the Queen's campus, I acknowledge that Queen's is situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory, and we are grateful to be able to live and learn on these lands. I'd now like to welcome our guest speaker for today, Dr. Gabor Lukacs, a leading expert on air passenger rights. Dr. Lukacs received his PhD in mathematics from York University in 2003. He held postdoctoral fellowships at the University of Bremen and Dalhousie University, and assistant professorships at the University of Manitoba and Dalhousie. Since 2008, Dr. Lukacs has been advocating for air passenger rights. He has filed more than 24 successful applications with the Canadian Transportation Agency, which resulted in orders directing air carriers to amend their conditions of carriage to the benefit of passengers. In 2013, the Consumers Association of Canada awarded Dr. Lukacs its Order of Merit for initiating legal action that resulted in changes to Air Canada's unfair practices regarding overbooking. In 2023, the Public Interest Advocacy Center awarded Dr. Lukacs the Harry Gow Award for Outstanding Advocacy in Transportation, Competition, and Essential Services. Dr. Lukacs has appeared before courts across Canada as both a party and an intervener, including the Federal Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada. In 2024, Dr. Lukacs intervened at the Supreme Court of Canada in the airline's challenge to the air passenger protection regulations, in which the court decisively sided with consumers. Particularly relevant to today's talk, he successfully challenged the CTA's lack of transparency and the reasonableness of the CTA's decisions at the federal court. In 2025, Dr. Lukacs was awarded the King Charles III Coronation Medal for his service to the community, to Nova Scotia, and to Canada. In terms of the format for today's talk, we will have time for questions at the end, but I'll be monitoring that Q&A box that you see at the bottom of your screen as we go along. So as questions come to you, feel free to type them in there in the moment. And then I'll gather those questions and we'll have the Q&A at the end of the talk. So welcome, Dr. Lukacs, to Queen's Law, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for this kind invitation to be at this seminar, this public talk. And I'm very grateful to Professor Henderson and Queen's University for this opportunity. I just would like to start with a disclaimer, just because I know that some airlines and their lawyers are probably watching and looking for new ideas of how to be difficult with us. I just want to be clear that I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice. And this is just for academic purposes only. So don't try it at home. I would like to start with just giving you a bit of background of how this issue of openness in airline complaints and the open court principle and the non-disclosure agreements came to be, and then go back through more the systemic history of it. So let me begin from a very relatively recent event. Just me give you, like in a Shakespearean play, who is who. We have the Canadian Transportation Agency, which is an economic regulator of the airline industry. It adjudicates consumer disputes between passengers and airlines, and it is supposed to be an arm's length from Transport Canada, although some people will argue that it's a very stubby arm. Then we have Danny Ross, who at all times material, an employee of this federal regulator, is acting director, dispute resolutions branch. And then there is Tim Roger, a passenger, who in 2024 won a complaint before the Canadian Transportation Agency at WestJet, and he, to his bad luck, he actually dares to post the ruling in his case in his favor in our Air Passenger Rights Canada group. So this is where the story starts, and here's now Tim's own account of what he recalls happening around July 4th. So he says, I was driving in downtown Chicago when it, the call came in. He, that was Danny Ross, the government agent, was polite, introduced himself, and said that it had been brought to his attention that I had posted the decision online. I told him that I had posted it on a private group. He said it was confidential, and as such, I was not to be sharing it. And according to Tim, I was afraid that I might get in a load of trouble. So eventually, he just agreed to remove a decision upholding his complaint against WestJet from a Facebook group out of fear that he may get into trouble. This was not the end of the story, though. The same Danny Ross then, about 5 days later, sent me an email asking me to cooperate with the Canadian Transportation Agency in suppressing passengers posting about their own decisions, their own cases, the evidence that has been happening, the situation that has been happening with them in our Facebook group. So this is the text of his email, and he was thanking me for my collaboration in preventing future public sharing of confidential information, and thanking me for my collaboration. Now, we are going to talk a bit more about why this was so troubling and its more historic background. But let's first acknowledge that in a very technical sense, Danny was referring to an existing legislation that was passed by Parliament. And that's Section 85.09, subsection 1 of the Canada Transportation Act, which has been in force since September 2023, which does actually make confidential all documents, all evidence, all information provided by a passenger and the airline to the complaint resolution officer dealing with a passenger's complaint against an airline, unless both parties agree to share it or to make it public. And of course, airlines are not going to rush to agree to share anything about their practices, anything that they always claim that everything, anything they do is top secret is going to cause them a lot of harm if they share it. So essentially, this is a provision that does indeed render this type of information confidential. So let me just acknowledge that Danny Ross was not bluffing. There was indeed such a provision. There is such a provision on the law books, and that's part of why we are deeply concerned at Air Passenger Rights, because it didn't stop with that phone call in 2024. But in 2025, the Canadian Transportation Agency posted on its website a notice about an intention to amend its regulations. The Canadian Transportation Agency's designated provision regulations sets out specific provisions of the Act and other regulations that if a person or a corporation violates them, then they can be punished by way of an administrative monetary penalty. It's essentially a fine. And it's like maybe a speeding ticket type of structure where they send you a notice. We believe you violated this. And if you disagree, then you have to go to the Transportation Appeal Tribunal of Canada and have a full hearing there. So that very same provision, just to be clear, this provision that we are talking about, which requires the confidentiality, that is the provision that they are proposing, or they were proposing, to add to the list of provisions that are designated in a way that if you violate it, then you will be facing a fine. Needless to say, we don't think it's right. So in May earlier this year, we, that's Air Passenger Rights, commenced an application in the Ontario Superior Court of Justice for a declaration on the one hand that this provision under which this entire phone call was happening, which purports to make all the evidence, all the decisions, all the reasons confidential, is unconstitutional, and it violates Section 2B of the Charter and cannot be saved by Section 1, and a declaration that actually the failure to make the decisions and the orders and the reasons for them public is itself a violation of Section 2B of the Charter that cannot be saved by Section 1. And if you're interested, that hearing is going to happen in March 2026. And stay tuned. We will have more information on it in our social media channels. So we are pursuing this very, very vigorously, this constitutional challenge. But let's make a step back and discuss now why this is wrong. And of course, if you just think as an average citizen without putting on your legal instinct or law student or lawyer hat, there's something fundamentally wrong with a government agency telling any citizen you should not talk about this or that thing that happened to you. That should raise some alarms. But there is a far deeper issue there, because theoretically you could say, well, yes, it may not be right, but Parliament made a law, and if that law was passed by Parliament, then you just have to follow it. However, there is a charter issue, because the right to know what is happening in court or in legal proceedings and access to exhibits is not just a question of what feels right to you. It's not just a question of your think or your opinion of what is right, but it's actually a well-established legal right in the Canadian and, in fact, in common law legal system. And that is bring us to the discussion on the open court principle. So the open court principle substance is about information about court proceedings. It entails public's access to information. So you as a member of the public have a right to know what is happening in the court. It entails the media's right to gather information and to publish and broadcast that information. And it entails also listeners and viewers' rights to receive that information from the media. In reality, you are not going to sit in every courtroom across Canada and listen to old court hearings. It is the media and reporters that do that service for the public, for us as citizens, and therefore the media's access to court hearings and including exhibits is vital. In practice, I'm not sure if you've ever done it before. I've done it a number of times. There was an interesting federal court case I found, and I went down here in Halifax. They have amazing court stuff here, the Halifax Registry, went down there and said, hi, I would like to have a look at file number T1234 of 2024. And then they would order it for me, the full big box of documents from Ottawa. And I would actually be able to go through each and every document that was filed in the federal court in that particular file and make copies of it, take photos, take scans, do it as I please, because those documents are public, they're on a public record, and I have the right to think about them, to express opinions about them, to publish about them, to do with them as I please. Those are all public information. There are, of course, some exceptions to the open court principle, and that is well recognized. The leading case currently in Canada is the Sherman Estate from Supreme Court of Canada. But the overarching principle is that, for example, we want to protect the identity of young persons, even if they are young offenders under the various youth criminal legislation, and very importantly, victims. If somebody, God forbid, is a victim of a sexual assault, we don't want that person to have to necessarily have their name out there. In many cases, there are presumptions of publication bans to protect the innocent, to protect the victims. Mm-hmm. There's also protection for accused rights to fair trial, sometimes in jury selection or in bail hearings or in some pretrial procedures in criminal proceedings. You do have information in the courtroom that could affect the accused right to a fair trial. Those things are covered typically by a publication ban, automatic or not. And then there's a last category of national security that comes to mind, where you don't necessarily want on public record information about informants or how Canada's security services collected information to thwart a terrorist attack. There are also other categories which are recognized. I'm just touching on it quickly, which things like nuclear secrets, it's more national security, I guess. There can be some kind of commercial trade secrets where some part of the information must be made confidential in order to protect the purpose of why they are confidential to begin with, but these are really exceptions. The general rule is that court proceedings have to be public. And this is not something just coming from a charter. It's coming from much earlier times. One of the cases that I've seen cited in Canadian Supreme Court decisions, and I myself have been referring to in a court challenge that I launched, which we are going to talk about in a moment, is Scott versus Scott. That's from the House of Lords. And the issue there before the House of Lords was the validity of an order directing an embarrassing divorce case be heard in camera. And just like in the Canadian Transportation Agency's case, whether parties were required to keep details of the hearing in secret after the trial. This is exactly what happened to our hero, Tim, who posted about the outcome of his case. He was glowing that, yes, I won my case against WestJet. Here's my decision in my favor, just like about 100 years ago happened in Scott versus Scott. So different law lords weighed in on this issue. These are just a few quotes or a few points that I would like to highlight. Vikant Haldane said, to justify an order for hearing in camera, it must be shown that the paramount object of securing that justice is done would really be rendered doubtful of attainment if the order were not made. So essentially, it has to be really necessary for the functioning of the court, for making justice, to actually make the proceeding confidential. Earl Lorburn actually went further. It said, Earl Lorburn said that it is not that a court ought to refrain from exercising its power in such a way, it is that the court does not possess such a power. So even it's not clear to Earl Lorburn whether even the court can make an order to not talk about what happened at trial afterwards. And Lord Shaw of Dunfermline cited actually Jeremy Bentham with approval, which was very poetic. If you read those reasons, very poetic and very well written, very passionate reasons about the importance of ensuring that court proceedings remain public. In the darkness of secrecy, sinister interest and evil in every shape have full swing. Only in proportion as publicity has place can any of the checks applicable to judicial injustice operate. Where there is no publicity, there is no justice. And then going on, publicity is the very soul of justice. It is the keenest spur to exertion and the surest of all guards against improbity. It keeps the judge himself while trying under trial. And the security of security is publicity. It really rhymes in some ways with Justice Brandeis, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, different context. But it really shows how more than 100 years from now, and well before the charter, it was a strong sentiment, a strong consensus legally that court proceedings have to be public. And not only in the UK. When we turn to Canada, this is a case before the charter, the Nova Scotia Attorney General versus McIntyre case from 1982. It's a pre-charter case where the Supreme Court of Canada very firmly and strongly rejected the idea that privacy of litigants would in and of itself be sufficient to outweigh the right to a public hearing, the public's right to know what is happening in the legal system. And the considerations being invited here are also very compelling. One is about public confidence in the integrity of the legal system. And it again comes back to the same notion, the same idea from the Scott versus Scott, that the curtailment of public accessibility or public access to judicial proceedings is warranted only if there is a need to protect social values of superordinate importance, like protection of the innocent. This is a very strong cautionary wording already from more than 40 years ago that the openness of the court proceedings is not to be taken lightly. It is not just an afterthought. It's not just a ceremonial purpose, but it has a very important function going to the integrity of the entire legal system. Now, after charter came into place, in CBC versus New Brunswick, the court actually held that the open court principle is inextricably tied to the right guaranteed by Section 2B of the charter. And the rationale is a very obvious one. It allows public access to the information about the courts. It allows discussion, putting forward opinions, and criticizing. It is essential for freedom of expression, freedom of ideas, and the right of members to obtain information about the courts is itself inherently tied to the freedom of expression, freedom of speech, which is protected by Section 2B of the Charter. Moving on to the next milestone is already a 2004 decision from the Vancouver Sun, which again reminds courts, reminds decision makers that openness is necessary to maintain independence and impartiality of courts. It is integral to public confidence in the judicial system and the public's understanding of the administration of justice. There's also an aspect that more and more coming into those authorities, raising the point that the more the public understands how justice is being made, the more the public is likely and willing to comply with judicial decisions. The upshot of all this is that the open court principle, to put it mildly, is not to be lightly interfered with. Yet another very stern warning from our top court. This is not to say that the open court principle is absolute. As we know under Section 1 of the Charter, legislation can sometimes limit freedoms subject to the Oaks test. The Oaks test is the legal test, the framework to decide whether a government action or legislation infringes the Charter right in a manner which is justified under Section 1 of the Charter. And courts have developed a number of tests, the Degané, the Mentuk test earlier, than the Sierra Club test and the Sherman test, to balance freedom of expression and other important rights and interests, which is essentially what those tests do, and the way have been described by the courts, is that they are they incorporate the Oaks test. They are the adaptation of the Oaks test in a way to the specific question of freedom of expression, open court principle versus other important societal interests. So it is not to say that though the Oaks test is different or that these are superseding. It's just that in a specific context of open court principle, one has to adopt and those tests have been adopted for reduced a more easy to apply framework. And looking at the current state of the law, the Sherman test, Sherman is about discretionary exercise of confidentiality. So say you are arguing an intellectual property case before the federal court, maybe a patent case, and you must ensure that some trade secrets are not put on the public record. And you make a motion under Rule 151, 152 of the federal court's rules, seeking a confidentiality order. And then the court would be looking at these factors whether or not to exercise discretion in a manner that limits open court presumption. And the three factors are whether there is a serious risk to an important public interest, whether it's necessary to prevent serious risk because there is no reasonable minimal other alternative measures. That goes well with the minimal impairment aspect of the Oaks test, and whether as a matter of proportionality, the benefits of the order outweigh its negative effects. So that's about the judicial exercise of discretion. And then we come back to Canadian Transportation Agency. If we have all this law, all these constitutional rights, the open core principle, how does it jive with what the CTA was doing? Now, one thing that opponents of our position is going to say, yes, but that's our courts, but the Canadian Transportation Agency is an administrative tribunal. And let's just pause for a moment and ask ourselves, in Canada, when it is raining, what happens? There are mushrooms and new administrative tribunals coming up. One of the changes over the past few decades, if you even think of a more classic book like Unjust by Design, probably I think it's 20 or more year old, about how we have shifted in Canada from just purely judicial exercise of authority to a lot of administrative decisions. We do have lots of administrative decisions happening, but not every administrative decision is of the same nature. So It's important to distinguish that many decisions are made in a quasi-judicial capacity or proceedings. And already going back to a 1979 decision from the Supreme Court of Canada, this is an important delineation. What is quasi-judicial and what isn't? So the factors, the considerations that have been articulated by the Supreme Court of Canada and adopted by lower courts are the following four factors: whether there is something that contemplates some form of hearing before a decision maker, and a hearing can also be a paper hearing by in writing. It doesn't have to be in a room or be over Zoom. It can be just something in writing. Whether a decision or order directly or indirectly affects the rights and obligations of persons. That's a very, very important consideration. If there is an adversarial process and if there is an obligation to apply substantive rules to many individual cases rather than an obligation to essentially make policy. The more something feels like a policy, the less it's quasi-judicial, the more it is about weighing concrete facts, looking at how the law applies to those facts, maybe weighing the law, that would be quasi-judicial. So what happens with the open court principle in the quasi-judicial context? The first answer is coming from federal court from 1987, actually, from Southam versus Canada. The issue there was whether immigration detention or some form of immigration proceedings should be open for the public. And the federal court says, absolutely, yes. The court applied there the same test from the Supreme Court of Canada for determining what is a quasi-judicial capacity and said that those type of decisions that were being made were of a quasi-judicial nature, and it is not unreasonable to extend to such proceedings the open court principle. The rationale here was that when something walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So these kind of tribunals are doing essentially what courts would do. They're exercising the same type of function. They are part of the administration of justice. They need to have legitimacy to have confidence in their integrity. Public needs to understand how they work, why they work that given way. So the same principles that justify and tie freedom of expression and charter rights to the openness of courts also apply with the same force to quasi-judicial tribunals. Now, jumping ahead a couple decades, in Saskatchewan Court of Queen's Bench, in Germain versus Saskatchewan, the same issue came up. At that point, it was a clash between open court principle and privacy rights. In this case, the applicant was complaining that a decision relating to her would be posted on the website or some form of public of a quasi-judicial body. And the Saskatchewan Court of Queen's Bench went back again to McIntyre decision and said, these dicta are still the law in Canada, in my view, applied to adjudicative tribunals, which, although not courts, have a quasi-judicial function. Again, the same logic as from the federal court before. If it functions in the same way, the same type of function in terms of society as court, and in particular the adversarial process and determination of rights and obligations, then the same principles must apply to it. So these privacy arguments that have been advanced, they should not be given any effect. Now let's look back again at our Canadian Transportation Agency. The Canadian Transportation Agency is established by the Canada Transportation Act, and it consists, and I'm talking about before 2023, staff members who are necessary for the proper conduct of business and conduct facilitation and mediation of complaints, and members who are like judges who make orders, decisions, rules, regulations. They exercise the quasi-judicial powers of the Canadian Transportation Agency. They can make binding decisions. And in a 2014 decision, the Federal Court of Appeal very eloquently, succinctly summarized the Canadian Transportation Agency's two key functions. One of them was in its role as a quasi-judicial tribunal, it resolves commercial and consumer transportation-related disputes. So there can be no genuine dispute that at least in those times, and of course we say that even later, the Canadian Transportation Agency has been acting in a quasi-judicial role with respect to passenger complaints. When we look at the Canadian Transportation Agency's own rules of procedure, it seems that they have taken to heart the open court principle. And they had an older set of rules which required every document to be placed on public record unless there was a claim of confidentiality made in accordance with the rules. And the newer rules say essentially the same. All documents go on public record unless the person makes a confidentiality claim and is granted in accordance with the agency's rules. So on its face, it looks like the agency knows what it's supposed to do or knew what it was supposed to do. Again, before September 2023, everything was good. It was right in their rules that they have to follow the open court principle. So thumbs up, right? Well, as it so often happens in our country, just because you have rules written down doesn't mean that bureaucrats are going to follow them or not try to interpret them in a way that they find it favorable to whatever agenda they have. So when yours truly in February, wrote to the Canadian Transportation Agency that I wanted to have to view, I wanted to have access to a file that was decided by the members, and I told them I'm seeing access under Section 2B of the Charter, what I got back was heavily redacted documents. They essentially treated it as if I had made a request for access under the Access to Information Act, which I could have done it possibly, but I have chose absolutely not to, because as a member of the public, I have Section 2B rights under Charter to access those adjudicative records of a Canadian federal tribunal. I don't need to go through the access to information. I don't want to go through it. It would be actually to my disadvantage with all this exemptions that they could then apply discretionally, God knows what. We don't need to go there. Just the same way that I can walk down to the courthouse here in Halifax and look at any file which is not confidential, have the same right with the Canadian Transportation Agency, which they say here black and white that it is on public record. So you really wonder what kind of public record it is, which is not really public, which you get things redacted from it. And as it turns out, what they were redacting was the name and email address of counsel acting for Air Canada in the proceedings, names of Air Canada employees involved, and substantial portions of submissions and evidence. So we're not just talking about date of birth, credit card, which, by the way, they cannot redact under the open court principle, but it would at least morally would not be so affront to common decency. What was being redacted is quite substantial information about how the adjudication process was happening, who were the witnesses, and so on. I made a final demand for unredacted documents, and I got back a full page of a longer letter in which I believe it was a chairperson of the Canadian Transportation Agency at the time, who was going on and on about how Section 8 of the Privacy Act prevents the Canadian Transportation Agency from giving to me information which was, by the agency's own rules, supposed to be on public record. And I really love this paragraph about, although agency case files are available to the public for consultation in accordance with the open court principle, personal information containing such files, such an individual's home address, personal email address, personal phone number, date of birth, blah, 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 is not available for consultation. So it's a public, it almost sounds like a socialist joke, maybe a Soviet Union joke, that it is public record unless you ask for it, by which one it becomes non-public. Or you know, they used to say that there is a freedom of speech, freedom of expression in the Soviet Union, but just there's no freedom after expression. Of course, I would not take this, and I would not take no for an answer here, because it is, after all, a constitutional right. So I filed an application for judicial review in the Federal Court of Appeal, and I'm just mentioning it went right to the Federal Court of Appeal because of a specific provision in the Federal Courts Act. And instead of just coming to argue the case, the Canadian Transportation Agency then tried to throw a curveball at me, arguing that, trying to quash the application on the basis that the requirements of the access to information were not met. So they were yet again trying to force me to go through the Access to Information Act, even though I clearly made statements that I'm not asking under that act. I don't want to go through that act. I'm asserting just my constitutional rights as a citizen, just the same way if we go down to the Halifax courthouse to access documents. Fortunately, a couple months later, Justice Webb from the Federal Court of Appeal dismissed the agency's motion to quash. This is an important decision, which unfortunately is not published, so that's why I'm emphasizing it perhaps. The agency did not refer to any provision of the Access to Information Act that provides that the only right to obtain information from the agency is by submitting a request under that act. Indeed, the access to information is actually to augment, to enhance access to information in Canada. It is not to somehow restrain or restrict that order, the right of public to access information or charter rights. So that was the, on the procedural part, and trying to just sidetrack the whole process. And eventually, next year, the Federal Court of Appeal also held that what the Canadian Transportation Agency was trying to do was impermissible. If it is on public record, it is on public record. They cannot just claim that something is on public record, but you cannot access it at all. And that typical privacy argument was thrown out, and I finally got access to the documents. And from that point on, the Canadian Transportation Agency was more responsive to requests if I wanted to have access to documents. It was also warning people that if you put information there, it will be put on public record. So if you don't want your credit card number there, don't include it there, which is the correct approach. That's what happens in courts. Nothing special, nothing surprising about it. One more aftermath, which is beyond the Canadian Transportation Agency, is a challenge by the Toronto Star to Ontario's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. Because what that act was used to or purport to do is to prevent Ontario adjudicative tribunals from disclosing personal information in adjudicative records of Ontario tribunals. And the upshot of the decision was that those provisions of the Ontario privacy legislation were deemed to be of no force and effect because they were violating Section 2B of the Charter and not justified under Section 1. And in its aftermath, Ontario also passed the Tribunal Adjudicative Records Act in 2019, which actually positively requires and creates some kind of scaffolding for the public to obtain access to such records. And you know, you don't have to go through the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. There's no such requirements in Ontario either. It's a charter right. And obviously, if a tribunal is acting in a quasi-judicial capacity, you do have a right to access the decision documents that they are basing their decision on. So now let's digress a little bit and ask ourselves, where is all this secrecy, confidentiality is coming from? And this is where the non-disclosure agreements come into play. So non-disclosure agreement or a confidentiality clause is essentially an agreement or a clause in the agreement requiring the parties to keep certain information confidential. It can be, in many cases, very legitimate, like intellectual property. If you have a discussion, if you're an inventor, you have a discussion with investors or evaluators, certainly you don't want them to be at liberty to share with whoever they want your design, your concept, your algorithm, your unpatented manufacturing process, which you're hoping to patent. So all this makes perfect sense in mergers, acquisitions, joint ventures. It's quite common for companies to share highly sensitive financial information with each other. And of course, you need to be able to do it in a way that you can be sure that the information is not going to go to anybody. In employment contracts too, you may be working for a company which has its own trade secrets. They know how to make specially that particular type of beer or thing of Canada or some financial data or customer list. and maybe you're an insurance sales agent for an insurance company, you can have your own notebook for your own customers. But if you leave that company, you cannot just take all the customers with you. That would be a bit of a problem. So there are, of course, legitimate uses of NDA, and that's where it is coming from. It's necessary for normal business. However, there's also been an abuse of it, which was called out by the Canadian Bar Association in 2023, where it was being used to cover up shabby corporate conduct, workplace harassment, abuse in schools, youth clubs, religious institutions, you name it. These have been used also to essentially give used compensation legitimately owed to victims as hush money. Here's your money and keep your mouth shut about it and never, ever talk about it. And let's make no mistake, if you do sign an NDA, it is a lifelong commitment. Even if you were 20 when you signed it and you talk about it and you're 70, you could still be sued. And if you got some money when you were 20, they can demand back that money from you when you're 70, unless there is some waiver or some law which says that those are not enforceable. Certainly, when it comes to this type of abuses, it would be very welcome to outlaw them. I know there are a number of people advocating for outlawing NDA in a variety of areas. Construction law would be another area where, in Ontario, I know there are lots of problems with construction law where this are also an issue. Okay, but how does it come to passenger rights? Well, airlines, just like any other large corporation, love to use various myths to tell customers, yeah, we're going to settle with you, we're going to pay you compensation, but please sign this NDA here, sign this confidentiality clause. So what are the three main myths that we have seen here? One is that it is part of a standard form of full and final release. You agree to sign a release, so you agree to NDA as well. You have to sign an NDA as part of the settlement. The second type of myth is that the law requires you to keep terms of settlement confidential. And there was an article also in the CBC's Go Public last year about it, if I recall correctly, where even a lawyer for an airline was claiming that settlement privilege somehow required the passenger to agree to more than what actually is required by law. They will even tell you that it is unreasonable to reject an offer to settle because they want to include an NDA, and it is reasonable to insist on an NDA as a condition for settlement. So let's just have those myths in our mind, and let's now go through them one by one, and let's see what actually the law is. So in the first one, that is, it is part of a standard form of full and final settlement, actually the law is the opposite. A confidentiality clause is a significant burden on a party. It represents a restriction of his or her freedom of speech. A party may agree to such a clause, but he or she must be asked for it. So an airline or a corporation cannot argue that when you agree to settle and you agree to sign the release, you implicitly agree to an NDA. That is busted. The next myth is about the settlement privilege. It can be very intimidating as a passenger when you receive this kind of blurb from a lawyer. Oh, they must know what they are saying, that by settlement privilege, you have to agree to confidentiality. And the answer is no. Settlement privilege is not an NDA. It is an evidentiary rule. What settlement privilege stands for is that if you have settlement discussions, you cannot use them as evidence in court normally. There are some exceptions when there is a question of what actually has been agreed upon, but you can, just because the airline said, well, I think our case is really weak, we should probably pay you, you cannot show that to the judge and say, well, Your Honor, they admitted their case is weak, now please rule in my favor. That's not possible. That's what settlement privilege is about. If maybe you exchange documents as part of settlement negotiations, there may be settlement privilege attached to whether they can or cannot use that. But Supreme Court of Canada again reminds us that one is a rule of evidence, the other is a binding agreement. Rules of evidence, you cannot kind of contract out. But whether you do or do not agree to an NDA, that's up to you. And if you get an email from an airline telling you, we want to have settlement negotiations with you, but we want you to commit that you won't disclose as we talk to you about it, you can just say, sorry, if you have an offer, give it to me, but I cannot and will not commit to any kind of confidentiality. If they don't like it, tough. The airline either will then give you an offer to settle or will not give you an offer to settle, but they have no way, no right to impose confidentiality unilaterally on you, and they love to mislead passengers about it. And the third issue is about how reasonable or unreasonable it is to try to impose an NDA or try or reject an NDA because reject an offer to sell it because there is an NDA. So first of all, it is not unreasonable to reject an offer that requires you to sign an NDA. There is a recent case from British Columbia Supreme Court. It was usually this type of offer to sell issues come up in the context of cost awards, and the airline may argue, well, we should get a bigger cost award because we had this great offer for the passenger, but they turned it down, or to plaintiff in this case, but not an airline case. But actually, you are perfectly within your right to turn down an offer to settle, which includes an NDA. I would, however, personally suggest that you make it clear that you're turning it down because of the NDA and not for other reasons that can help you if it comes to issue of cost. Now, it is actually unreasonable to insist on an NDA as a condition for settlement, at least in the context of airlines. This is a case when WestJet was trying to do it to a passenger, and the judge, the small claims court judge from Ontario, did not mince his or her words in criticizing the airline. The inclusion of a term in the defendant's offer that this court cannot order, i.e. confidentiality clause, is problematic. This relief was not claimed in the defense file. Further, this court's jurisdiction is statutory. It could not order a non-disclosure agreement, and goes on. Courts cannot condone hardball tactics between litigants, especially in circumstances where there is a power imbalance between a corporate litigant, here the second largest airline in Canada, and an individual. While I do know the defendant made an offer to settle the week before trial, that offer had a serious defect. It did not allow for Mr. Douglas to receive his long overdue refund without other strings attached. So actually, the NDA was a serious defect. And the court goes on, I find the defendant's withholding of monies that admitted it owed in a 72-year-old plaintiff for more than 2 years and 7 months after the commence of litigation to be an unreasonable action within the, I think should be meaning, I'm not sure what it says remaining, but I think it should read meaning, the meaning of Rule 1906. And the Rule 1906 is about special cost awards against an unreasonable party, and that's what happens. I find the circumstances is reasonable to impose a cost penalty under Rule 1906, and in assessing a fair and reasonable penalty, I take judicial notice of the headlines of a record number of complaints over the past 2 years by Canadians to Canadian Transportation Agency and a current backlog of roughly 71,000 cases. This was in 2025 in March. By now, it's 86,000 complaints, by the way. So this decision, if you are arguing on the airline side at some point, be careful not to make this type of behavior, because this case is a stern warning that the airline should not try to impose NDA on the passengers. If you're a passenger, of course, you should always be reasonable. If they give you a good offer, which gives you what you want, I would accept it. But if they try to attach an NDA to it, write back and create a paper trail. I'm rejecting this offer because you are trying to restrict my freedom of expression, trying to attach an NDA to it, and that's not acceptable to me. So now let's go back to after this to, again, the what happened since September 2023 and this whole complaint resolution CRO process was created. So this was created in the Budget Implementation Act of 2023, it's an omnibus bill. Now, airlines complaints would be handled by complaint resolution officers who are CTA staff, not necessarily members. These CRO do mediation adjudication, and the fact that they do some mediation is the excuse I think the government is trying to advance partly as to why they are trying to impose this type of blanket confidentiality, and to avoid the existing case law and rules on openness and public access obligations, they put in there that proceedings before a complaint resolution officer are not proceeding before the agency. This provision itself is causing lots of other problems. Judicial reviews now going to federal court. Judicial review can be instituted on any question, not just on question of law or jurisdiction. No leave requirements. So of course, we warned lawmakers that this would be a problem, but government was not listening as usual. If you go to our website, we do have a detailed brief which sets out all the problems about this new regime that they were introducing. So where are we right now? Decisions, reasons, and evidence are no longer accessible to the public, to the media, to passengers, but only to a handful of airlines and their lawyers, who are the frequent respondents to complaints. Think of Air Canada. They're handling thousands and tens of thousands of cases before the CRO. They can compile big books of cases, big statistics. They can run AI, you name it, to draw advantage from the information they gain from all these interactions. But passengers, for them, it's a one-off case. There's one case they take to the CRO. They don't know how these cases are being handled normally. Airlines have also been trying to use this type of decisions in other cases or in small claims courts, even though it's supposed to be confidential. What actually does get published under Section 85.14 is just skeletal information of no use, like flight number and maybe some one-line outcome. No reasons, no evidence, no logic, nothing. But it's even a bigger problem. Passengers, reporters, NGOs like us, members of the public who discuss decisions, reasons, evidence about airline complaints could be facing reprisal. Let's remember, the Canadian Transportation Agency was proposing to impose fines for those who violate Section 85.09, subsection 1. So that's why we are going to be in court next March to ask the court read down Section 85.09 and declare it unconstitutional. That's a provision that would prevent public discussion. And I would like to just leave you with one question with respect to all this. Cui bono? Who benefits from all these rules? Thank you.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present music from Dusty Coyote's three-song EP, More Cowbell, produced by Emmy Award winner Gilbert Saladre and featuring Nick Lennox on saxophone. The record moves through garage indie dance energy on the title track, fuzz-drenched 1950s-inspired rock on Spend Your Savings, and closes with Eat at El Gringo, a surf rock Tarantino soundtrack-style homage to Kingston's favorite Mexican takeout window. Built for the dance floor? Play it loud. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream More Cowbell by Dusty Coyote on your favorite platforms and enjoy the title track with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
lights. I feel the turning on the lights. But I still hear it. Do you still hear it? So now we're gonna dance. I said now we're gonna dance in the streets. And now we're gonna dance all the way home to the cowbell. More cowbell. More cowbell. More cowbell. The cowbell. The cowbell. More cowbell. More cowbell. More cowbell.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Shades, the debut single from Kingston's Hey Buddy, the latest project from 18-year-old multi-instrumentalist Seb Heil. Layered guitars, airy vocals, and a mellow groove characterize the entire upcoming album, best suited for a campfire or a quiet day at the lake. Are you a local musician who'd like airplay and social media coverage on CFRC's channels? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram today. In the meantime, stream Shades by Hey Buddy on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.